From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula.
Hi, this is Troy Stangeron. I'm the senior director here at the Korea Economic Institute. Jenna Gibson is away this week, and I'll be filling in. I'm here today with Elise Hu from NPR. Elise opened up NPR's Seoul Bureau office. She covers both South Korea and Japan from Seoul. Elise, thanks for being here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
As the first bureau chief in Seoul, what were the types of challenges you faced opening up a new office in a foreign country?
A lot of them were administrative, so problems that you could probably expect. Having to set up a business license in order to establish an office in Seoul, trying to figure out how to get a visa and visas for my family that was coming along from the embassy here in D.C. That took a while, a lot of back and forth. Was I supposed to be working with the public affairs channel there at the embassy, or did I need to be working with consular? You know, so lots of little things. And then when I got there, the culture shock was difficult, namely in culture in the form of language. You know, I am Chinese American, so there are some things about East Asian culture that are run kind of across the Northeast Asia part of the region, but Korean, I didn't speak at all at the time, and so it was really difficult to just kind of not only get my bearings and report, but also figure out what I was buying at the grocery store and getting around.
I have a colleague who, when she and her husband, well, at the time boyfriend, moved to South Korea, they were looking for water because they were parched one night. And so they went and they bought the cheapest thing possible. And that's not actually water in South Korea. They ended up with soju.
Soju. Yeah. Yes. Yep. 99 cent. Yeah. Oh, so on the soju front, if anybody is listening, and I'm guessing that this is a lot of folks who are interested in Korea anyway. On the soju front, there's new grape soju, which is excellent. The jamon soju was my favorite, the grapefruit. And now there's a new flavor. So
I like grape. I'll have to try that next time I'm there. So when you opened the office, there was a bit of news that first day. What was it like to start on that specific first day, as I let you actually describe what happened?
Yeah, that's right. So I have been in Seoul now since March of 2015. And I don't know if y'all remember, but in March of 2015, in the beginning of that month, I had landed at Incheon the night before, and I was up really late, you know, because my daughter came with, and my pets, my dog and my cats, and we had to go get them from cargo, and we just didn't get to our new apartment for a long time. The next morning, sometime like around 8 a.m., the Ole internet guy came to set up my internet. So I didn't even have internet yet. And my husband sees from his phone, hey, the ambassador to Korea has been stabbed. He's been knifed in the face. But it turns out that was the incident in which Mark Lippert, the then ambassador to South Korea, and he was in his first couple of months in his time there, was knifed in the face by a North Korean sympathizer. And we had to spring into action right away. I thought I might have a week to get myself settled. And no, it was a breaking news day, and I was on the air that day.
Well, quite a way to start, but there's been a lot of things that have happened since you've been in South Korea. So I want to touch on a few of those. And, you know, one of the major things that happened while you were there was that, you know, we had the impeachment of Park Geun-hye. It started in 2016, sort of concluded, you know, in 2017 or last year. For you trying to cover a story like this, what were the major elements and what kind of things stuck out to you?
That was incredible to watch. By the time there was a real popular uprising, right, by the time that the people of South Korea were taking to the streets and in the tens of thousands and then the hundreds of thousands, I had never seen that kind of demonstration power, right, the number of people out there. And I had covered Ferguson in August of 2014, which was a significant American protest, and it was like nothing in terms of people compared to what we saw in South Korea. What struck me is how quickly that whole downfall, I guess, happened, right? The unraveling of Park Geun-hye and her power happened very fast in the scheme of things. And how quickly popular opinion changed against her. I was surprised that the revelations were so I guess the revelations were rather dramatic, right? That this Chaesunshil, who was the advisor to Pakkune, but kind of a secret Rasputin-like advisor, was choosing her clothes and advising on North Korea policy and writing speeches and starting a secret slush fund in which they were shaking down leaders of Chaebol, the conglomerates. And so all of this was just happening in the fall of 2016. And very quickly, you saw people take to the streets. And then very quickly, there was calls for resignation. And she refused to resign. And so the tensions there and the drama of it was all really fascinating to cover. But it was so significant. It was bigger than the Mad Cow protests that had happened in 2008 or so. So it was much bigger than that. And so I would argue it's kind of the biggest test of South Korea's democratic system really proving itself, right, since South Korea became democratic in the late 1980s. I don't think we saw the scale of protests as we did in 2016 since the late 1980s. It was huge.
So one of the things I'm curious about, you know, you were obviously there for a period under Park Geun-hye, and, you know, we're only a year now sort of removed from all of that. But have you seen any real shift, or has sort of things just gone kind of back to normal?
Well, the advantage and the strength of South Korea's institutions and systems showed us that, or really were seamless when it came to the transfer of power, right? So there were no runs on banks. There wasn't, you know, streetlights and traffic systems and all of that was, they were completely fine, even though the presidential office was being tested politically, right? So the things that we see in the developing world, we didn't see in developed Korea.
Yeah.
And the transition of power was really rather smooth. I'm glad to have seen that and to see the election. Moon Jae-in is a lot more competent as a leader, in that he seems to be making decisions for himself and doing a lot of diplomacy on his own. The difference between him and Park Geun-hye is that she was largely supported by staff and seen as aloof and imperious. And so there wasn't ever a time that you would see Park Geun-hye speak extemporaneously, like without a prepared remarks.
Yeah.
There weren't very many examples of where she was just warm, right? And like with the people. And Moon Jae-in, right away when he came in, made a point to say, I want government to be more accountable to you all. So let us know. He started this Gwanghwamun First Street program in order to get people to submit their questions and ideas for change. He wanted to be more directly responsible to his constituents, which is the country. And I think that he's done well in that area. And Koreans largely support what he's doing with North Korea. Numbers in the 80s now. His approval rating is remarkably high. And the Blue House will say that he is the most popular leader in the free world in terms of support from his own constituents. And so I don't know, because I haven't been studying like Macron's popularity ratings, but I would buy that. I mean, it's in the 80s, which is double American support for the American president.
Yeah, and I mean, 80% is high for pretty much any democracy, right, at any point,
right,
you know. So, you know, one of the other major events that you covered was obviously South Korea just hosted the Winter Olympics. What are some of the compelling stories out of, you know, this past, setting aside maybe the North Korea part,
sure,
even for a moment? But
yeah. Curling. Team Kim. Team Kim, originally named the Garlic Girls by the Junwang Ilbo. They are the women's curling team of South Korea from Uisong, which is a garlic-producing rural area, rural town. And they were the sensation of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games. South Koreans weren't paying that much attention to curling, but very quickly, as they established a 5-0 record and then started like climbing up in the process, very quickly gained a huge following. They ended up silver medalists, but they beat Japan, which is a big deal if you're Korean, on the way to winning that silver. And now they're all over advertisements, you know, on TV commercials, and just celebrated, especially the skip, the team captain, Annie, Annie Yogurt Kim. Which is a nickname. She has two nicknames, Annie and Yogurt, because there are a lot of elements that foreign media latched onto about that story and about that team. And one of them was that they gave each other English nicknames that were named after food. So one was yogurt, one was steak, you know, another was pancake. And it's just a really compelling team to watch. That really stood out to me as somebody who has one foot in Korea and one foot in the U.S.
So the other big story at the Olympics, obviously, was, you know, the North Korean visit and the North Korean participation. What was it like covering, you know, for the first time you have a member of the Kim family coming to South Korea? She seemed to be received well. What was that story like?
I was in the same arena as her when she came to watch the hockey match of the unified North Korean-South Korean team, the Team Korea hockey match. And I remember how normal it was and how normal they seemed, right? They seemed like any other visiting delegation. And that actually runs parallel to the Kim Jong-un Moon Jae-in summit, in that one thing that really struck me about that day was how normal he seemed, right? Because we had only seen Kim Jong-un in propaganda and in a lot of taped footage. And this was the first time there was so much just live footage of this despot. And he seemed like he'd been doing this diplomacy stuff for his whole life, right? He seemed very natural. He played it off really well, this moment of giving a joint press conference with another head of state, which he surely hadn't done before.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought that was really impressive, the normalcy of it. And it ran parallel to seeing Kim Yo-jong, the sister, doing the same thing when she was having dinner with Moon Jae-in, when he hosted a dinner at Cheongwa-dae, and when she was just as a spectator at sporting events, in the same way that Ivanka was a spectator at sporting events. And so the normalcy of it all was actually what stood out.
Yeah, and, you know, along those lines, like, I remember I was watching his arrival. And when, you know, they're coming down the steps, when he first steps out from the North Korean side, you know, you kind of expect authoritarian regime. It's all going to be very rigid. They're all going to be very formal. It was just like this mob who didn't seem to really know where it was going. You know, it was so kind of haphazard, almost, like you say, very normal.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that stands out about all of this sort of engagement, which is another part of this, you know, big story that you're covering while you're there and everything, is that last year, you know, we had the three ICBM tests. You know, you had the six nuclear tests. You had, you know, fire and fury and all of the other name-calling between, you know, President Trump and Kim Jong-un. So you've gone from this very tense situation where people thought, you know, there might actually be war, to now the complete opposite. What has it been like covering such a significant shift in basically attitudes and perceptions?
It's been relentless. So this beat was already rather intense because Korea is such a dynamic place, and there was just a lot of news even domestically when it came to the democratic demonstrations and then deposing Park Geun-hye. So in the run-up to the North Korea end of this story, there was already a lot going on. But then now to see this dramatic turnaround from last summer to this spring, I can't catch my breath, you know, like it's really hard to come up for air. And that's what it is like as a news reporter. I think that when I have more time away from this moment, I think we're going to all be able to stand back and reflect upon it a little bit more and see maybe it'll all look like it makes sense, right? Because in a lot of ways, Kim Jong-un had telegraphed everything that he's doing. In setting out Byungjin as his policy, and then in his turnaround saying, at his New Year's speeches, essentially saying, listen, I didn't do enough on one front, now I'm going to do more on the economic front. He's really set benchmarks and then gone after them and met them and been very linear and rather logical. What's been the more of the wild card is American policy. And I think any Korea observers would tell you that, right? Like, it's a little bit unclear or plainly unclear what American objectives are besides this large notion of denuclearization. Like, what does denuclearization mean? And what is the Trump administration going to ask for in the upcoming summit with Kim Jong-un? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I mean, even in Pompeo's comments, you know, he seems to be indicating that at least in terms of their talks with the North Koreans, it's been very structural so far. It's not really maybe getting into a lot of these details yet, potentially.
Right, and that the devil's in the details, right? Because that's where administrations in the past have been burned. You have a lot of people here in Washington who have been at the table with North Koreans from the 90s through Obama's administration, and they're burned, right? There's a lot of baggage from bad faith, right? And now I think this is an opportunity for a reset in a lot of ways because the Trump administration or Donald Trump himself seems to work without a lot of history and context. And that frees him in some ways to say, all right, we're gonna maybe be more okay with abandoning some notions that were considered immutable in the past, for example, troops on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, and, you know, it's sort of interesting, you know, you talk about this sense of being burned. You know, one of the things that Kim Jong-un actually talked about when he met with Moon Jae-in was this sense of disappointment for things not being implemented. And so there's part of me that wonders if he understands that that kind of goes both ways.
Yeah. What parts of implementation did he mean? Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, the optics of all of this right now are really strong for both Koreas because I think that the other thing coming out of Panmunjom that day was the sense that, you know, this is a nation that's been ripped apart and for so long. And at the end of the day, they're both Koreans and they speak the same language and they have the same cultural mores historically. And that this tension has really affected an entire people, right? And it's totally separate from what America thinks about the Korean problem because America and Americans think about the nuclear issue primarily and almost exclusively. But for Koreans, it's a lot about their shared history and how to repair the damage of war.
I'm curious, you know, as we sort of focus on this process going forward and as you're covering it, are there any issues about denuclearization or the summit that you feel, you know, maybe should be focused on but aren't really getting maybe the attention that they deserve?
Well, human rights, of course. I mean, this hasn't really been talked about besides the fact that these three prisoners that were imprisoned by North Korea as political pawns were released. And so thank goodness and great for their families and very relieved. But North Korea has a general kidnapping as policy, right? There are not only 12 Japanese abductees since the 1970s that are still there or believed to still be there, but there's some 500 South Koreans that have been abducted or taken political prisoner since the beginning of the North Korean state. That doesn't get talked about. And so while I do hope that there is diplomatic engagement and I support the notion of engagement in general in, as opposed to war, as opposed to military action, I do hope that there is a cost to North Korea, right? That North Korea bears some burden and takes some responsibility for its past actions in whatever deal comes out of this round of talks.
So I'm curious, in a similar vein about things that maybe are less covered, in your time in South Korea, is there anything you covered that you thought was really interesting or really important, but for whatever reason just didn't seem to catch on that you kind of thought would or wished had?
I personally think I don't explore enough South Korean society because I end up covering North Korea and the North Korean nuclear issue and the concerns of Americans at the expense of really digging into South Korean society, which is interesting in and of itself. And South Korea is the 11th largest economy in the world. So 11th largest economy in the world, its ideas, its electronics, its trends, its culture is exported all over the world. And yet there's a lot of things socially that are real stressors for Korean society. I would say gender equality is a huge one. Yeah. South Korea ranks at the bottom for birth rate, fertility rate. At this rate, South Koreans will go extinct by 2750. So this is not something that should be ignored as a problem. And the inequality, the gender inequality, expresses itself in a lot of ways. It expresses itself in advertisements. If you go to Seoul and you walk around Seoul, there's only one kind of advertisement in Seoul, and it's a pretty woman holding up a product or the face of a pretty woman advertising her face and how you can surgically alter your face to get that face. This is this is the problem staring at you in the face.
Literally in the face.
Right, literally in the face. And it's that women are objectified, and the population of women working in the labor force in South Korea reached 50% in 2000 and has ticked up only 3 or 4 percentage points since 2000. And so there's an entire half of the population that's not being employed fully, which really has economic effects. And then what we've also seen is that countries that have more labor force participation by women also have higher birth rates, because if you're not forcing women to make this choice, a mutually exclusive choice of work or home, then they're going to choose both, you know? And so there need to be some real societal questions and more people speaking out about this and making women feel like they have a voice to try and aggravate for change. I would like to do that, and I have in various ways of highlighting some of the unfair beauty standards and things like that and just talking to you about it now, but I certainly wish I would have done it more.
One last thing I'd like to talk to you about. While you were in Seoul, you've done a series of short videos looking at different social and cultural issues. What sort of inspired you for this series to do this?
Yeah, so I have a video series called Elise Tries, and it's a whole lot of fun. It's in South Korea and in Japan, and we released a season of these episodes. What inspired me to do it in the first place was just, like, I was in Asia, and there were cool things, right? And I wanted everybody to see them. What ended up happening is then there were a lot of experiences that you could actually try out. And so Elise Tries is a series of experiments. So I went to a raccoon cafe, for example, and got my audio equipment stolen by a raccoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you should see that one. And I tried out a K-pop dance class where we tried a BTS video, and I was almost 7 months pregnant at the time. And so a lot of these things are kind of goofy, but also hopefully help translate some aspect of Korean or Japanese society to a larger audience. There's a lot of our audience that hasn't been to Northeast Asia, and so I see my role as somewhat diplomatic, somewhat trying to show in different ways what life is like. Not in a, like, hey, look at Weird Asia kind of way, but really in a generous and hopefully empathetic way. Like, hey, this is cool. This is what it might illuminate. And hopefully, you know, folks can better understand this place as a result.
Yeah, and I think it sort of fits, too, into, you know, your comment earlier, not necessarily about the problems, but that, you know, we tend to focus so much on the North Korea side of things that, even setting aside maybe, you know, the issues that, you know, South Koreans should be looking into that maybe people be interested in, but all of the good things that South Korea has done or all the interesting things that take place there tend to get sort of washed over by all this other stuff.
Yeah, and South Korea is so fascinating. Its economic growth is so fascinating, and how fast and how dynamic the society is, I'm constantly impressed by. I will always consider it a second home. 2 out of 3 of my children were born in Korea. And so there, that will always be a huge emotional tie to the country.
So one last question for you. Will we be getting a second season of Elise Tries?
We're working on it now. Yes, we're working on it now.
Cool. Well, I'm sure we all look forward to that. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Troy.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me. And thank you, everyone, for listening here again on Korean Context. Please do feel free to subscribe, of course, and leave us your thoughts. Let us know what you think of this conversation or about our podcast in general. And we'll see you here next time with another great episode.